when you say that this is the first time you've done press for this, like, can we go that, let's backtrack to that, like,
better late than never. Yeah. I'm supporting this movie. I think you said at some point your mom was mad that I didn't do more press for Go. I'm doing it for Alan.
I don't know if you remember, you sort of got me all fired up that, like, movie press was, because you were quite the liberal back then.
I wouldn't, liberal means something different in Canada.
Okay, sorry.
Liberal's like center, yeah.
Fired up.
Okay.
And you were like, this, you know, movie press is such BS, and all people talk about is, like, what clothing I wear, and, like, there's real issues in the world people should be talking about, and not, like, what the name of my, you know, pet is. And you got me all convinced, so when Sony said, all right, it's time to start talking about press, I was like, Sarah and I aren't doing press.
You said you weren't doing it either?
Yeah, you got me all fired up, because it's all BS, and they focus on the wrong things. And they were like, all right, let me explain to you how this works. Like, if you don't promote this movie, no one will go see it. And Doug, you're going to have to set the example and do the most, you know, like, the crappiest press of all, and then hopefully that will sort of convince the actors to follow along. But, like, there's no version of you not doing press. So
I was 19 and you were like 30, right?
Yeah.
So.
And then cut to, they were like, and the first thing you're gonna have to do is there's a, you know, Los Angeles Magazine's doing a piece on up and coming directors, you know, posing in pictures.
Oh yeah.
From their like an image from their favorite movie, and. And Brett Ratner's already done his, and he's like, in The Graduate, he's in like a chaise, they showed me the picture, he's like in a chaise lounge chair with like sunglasses and a Mrs. Robinson leg in the foreground. I'm like, oh my God, you look like such an asshole. Like, I was like, they're like, you have to do this. Like, and you set an example for Sarah so that she will follow suit and do some press so people will go see this movie. And I was like, oh my God, there's no way to not look like an a-hole. And then I thought, you know, I'm going to pick the full Monty. Because somebody's going to say no. Somebody along the way is going to say no. Because I'm like, because we had four male producers. So I was like, it's got to be me and the producer. So there's five of us, like the full Monty. And we had to be naked.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, the producers are going to say no, or the magazine's going to say no, or someone's going to say no. And cut to 2 weeks later, I'm at a photo studio in West Hollywood, and Mickey Liddell's brought two bottles of wine. He's like, we all better start drinking. And we did this naked photo shoot for Los Angeles Magazine.
Oh my God, do you still have a copy of that?
Well, it's online.
Oh, okay. God, I haven't done that.
And I'm sure my mom, you know, kept a copy.
Was Full Monty really one of your favorite movies?
It really was.
I feel like it was.
Yeah.
Like, that's, really?
Yeah. Really?
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I don't have the best memories of that movie.
Really?
Yeah, no. Like, I mean, I remember, I mean, it's, maybe the, I don't know.
But honestly, I wasn't picking it because it was my favorite movie. I was picking it because I was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to pose naked.
But, so you didn't do, and end up doing any, and you did a few, a little bit, right? Because I did a
lot. Yeah, I had to try to do whatever I could.
But, okay,
I
mean, was it just because press was like, because of those reasons?
I mean, you know, like, my life until, like, a year before making this movie had been full-on political activism and nothing else for years. Like, I hadn't been in school, I hadn't been in the film industry, so, like, it all seemed, like, hypocritical and awful and stupid.
Right.
And probably I've just lost touch with that feeling in some kind of sellout way. But, like, I do feel like it was, it came out of principle and out of integrity, and that, you know, actors and movies should not be taking up airspace. Important issues should. The truth is, like, it's not like in the absence of me doing an interview about Go, someone printed something about homelessness.
Right,
you know
right.
what I mean? Like, it was a pretty naive thing. And I think also probably over the years, especially now that I make my own films, you realize there's, you know, sometimes 100 people working extremely hard to make something.
Right.
And then it's sort of on you to get it out there, and then you don't, and that's kind of painful for the people involved in the production. So I would say my view on doing press for films is slightly evolved, but at the same time...
A little late.
It's very late, because I'm of no use to anybody. But we're doing this podcast now, like, you're welcome for promoting your movie. Finally. But yeah, I think that, I really, really didn't want to be in the public eye, and I really didn't want to have any kind of fame, and I was very stressed about the idea of being in a movie that was being pushed to be out there. Like, at that age, that was my, like, real
phobia. Even from the beginning, you thought that you were nervous at Hollywood. You'd want to do a Hollywood movie.
I didn't want to do this movie.
Yeah, you wouldn't even meet with me because you thought I was too Hollywood.
But so then how did you convince her? Like, how does that, that's what it means to you. Like, if you didn't want to be in the public eye, why would you go into this movie?
I was in LA to do a reading for Audrey Wells' movie, Guinevere, which I loved. Like, I was, like, obsessed with that script and trying to get that part, and I was there to do a reading. And then I'd read Go, and I remember just, like, it was a good script. Like, it's obviously a great script, but, like, I was just, it was not where I saw myself going. I wanted to do much more serious movies. And then I had said no, and I feel like I said no again. And then I basically got told, like, on your way to the airport tomorrow, like, in the lobby, you're going to see Doug Liebman. He's just coming to your hotel.
No, we had lunch.
Yeah, but, like, it was, like, not voluntary.
Yeah, because we threatened your agent. We said something. We told her that, you know, she wasn't going to be able to put anyone else in the movie if she couldn't. We knew you were in LA, and you're like, she has to at least sit down with Doug.
Something happened. But then, in that meeting, I felt like, because you were talking a lot about filmmaking and about how you shot things and about light and about how people were still lighting as though, you know, they had to, like, you know, outline someone's hair to separate from the background, and that didn't need to happen anymore because, you know, film is different. We're shooting in color. And you were sort of talking about this, and I'd never actually been interested in filmmaking before that. Like, I'd sort of been begrudgingly acting in things I really believed in, but it was the first time where someone started talking about filmmaking, and I was like, that's fascinating. So then I struck a deal that I would do it if I could apprentice you. Is that how you remember it?
Yeah, but you don't remember asking for the script at the end of that lunch?
No.
It's interesting because we've never talked about this, but I always think of this as being the critical moment, but maybe it wasn't, that after this lunch that she obviously was very begrudgingly having with me, she was like, okay, fine, give me the script. And I'm like, okay. I don't have it with me.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You're like, what do you mean? Aren't you here to, like, convince me to be in your movie? And I'm like, no, but I'll get it sent over. And she's like, no, I'm heading to the airport right now. I'll read it on the flight home.
Oh, I guess I hadn't read it then. Okay.
And you were like, why? You're like, how could you not have the script with you? It was the start of this relationship. this sort of mother hen kind of like, what kind of director are you? Yeah. You're here to convince an actress to be in your movie? And you don't have a copy of the script with you? And I was like, you're like, I don't have time. I'm going to the airport right now. That's my car out there. I was like, you know what? I bet you there's one in my car. And my car is like a total mess.
I remember the trunk.
I started rummaging through the trunk.
And you gave me a dirty old script. I found a dirty old copy
of Go that Steve Marioni, my editor, had marked up. And Steve is we have, you know, we're like brothers. He's very, you know, and he can be very critical. So I'm looking at the script and, like, I just flip it open to see what he's marked in it. And I can see, like, the second page, he's, like, circled something very angrily and wrote, like, this is a stupid line.
Yeah.
And then, like, a few pages later, it was, like, dumb. And the whole thing is just filled with criticisms of the script. And it's the only copy I have. And that's what I handed to you.
I forgot that. It's funny. I just all of a sudden had this image of how filthy your trunk was. But that's right. The script.
And in my mind, I was thinking, like, because you so didn't want to be in a Hollywood movie that there probably was no version of handing you a copy of Go that would have been more appealing than one that was so deprecating, self-deprecating. But maybe that's my imagination of you reading it on the plane. And
yeah.
Did the criticisms help?
Yeah, I think the idea of apprenticing Doug and learning about filmmaking.
Did that actually happen? So you were like, I do know your transitioning into filmmaking happened. Soon after.
I mean, cut to, like, you know, this is the first day of shooting at a grocery store, and Doug's got, like, the camera on one shoulder and a manual for the camera open in front of him. And I was, okay.
Yeah, she might have had better people to apprentice
this. Maybe this isn't going to be his plan. I'm not going to learn quite as much as I thought. Maybe I should just get the manual.
Wait, I got a quote here from Sarah that has traveled, and I don't know when you did this quote. This pops up in several interviews. It's, Doug Liebman is this complete mess who can barely keep track of his possessions.
Aww. Do you remember this? I said all sorts of nice things in that article too, but they just printed that.
That might particularly...
But that's true.
I mean, I can't argue with that as last night at 4 in the morning when we wrapped shooting, and I'm like, all right, I got to go back to the office and get my stuff before we head back, and one of my producers is like, no, I think I saw you with your stuff on the set earlier today, and like, Everyone's so tired, and now we're like rummaging through all the sets to try to find all my crap so I can come home. So
but,
I guess that was
better.
Fair.
You've gotten better.
Well, that was last night.
But because even on the audio commentary of the movie, your editor's talking about how he had to, you tried to show Sarah a great scene, and yeah. he had to block you off, or they didn't let you in the edit suite or something. Like they kept the hard drives away from you, like, and you couldn't show her the scene.
That wouldn't surprise me that, like, you know, I wanted to show something to Sarah. I may have wanted to record some line with her. Like I'm always going to want to keep tinkering.
Yeah.
I was doing inserts for Go, like, in our editing room.
Right.
Including, like, the hotel room catching on fire.
What does that mean, inserts?
Well, you know, like, shooting little teeny shots.
Because
I shot the film myself, so I had the camera. I'd just go back to the rental house and get the camera out. And, you know, we didn't have the images of, like, the fire starting in the hotel room.
Right, right.
So I went and got some curtains and, you know, some tissue paper. And actually, I was surprised at all the stuff I bought at Home Depot that, like, I didn't get, like, cited for, you know... Terrorism is like, you know, lantern battery and steel wool and wires and switches, and a fire extinguisher, and was like shooting images of the fire starting, right, like in the corner of the editing room. And Steve was like, he was getting pretty upset because he's like trying to edit a movie and like I'm starting a fire in the next room over and filming it.
Suddenly, I have this recollection of when I was shooting Guinevere at nights. Like you and I going around in your car and like just shooting stuff on the street
while
you were editing.
Yeah. And I would go to raves with the camera and film the raves. Mm-hmm. I got attacked at a rave.
What do you mean?
Literally, like...
Like, for
some
the camera?
Kid was like, no, like, literally trying to beat me up. And I'm like, got the camera on my shoulder. I'm trying to fend him off with my other arm. And...
But okay, so let's go back to the beginning then about you signing on board with this movie. Doug, why did you sign on to this movie? Like, what made you jump onto the script?
I just loved the script, and I loved the challenge of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd just done Swingers, which was, you know, one of those rare independent films that suddenly, you know, it's like the one in a million independent film where suddenly you're getting offered studio jobs.
Hmm.
And my agent was saying, you got to take a studio film because, like, you can't go make another independent movie because what if that doesn't perform, you're back to square one. Like, while the door's open, you got to go through it. And there was, like, this, you know, bigger, more commercial comedy that I was thinking about and deciding between that film and Go. At the end of the day, what I loved about Go was the characters and how challenging it was going to be to make this movie with so many parts, and it was just, and for a small amount of money, I think that was part of the appeal to me, was like I kind of, from the day I said yes to Go, I was going to be sort of, you know, like in a crisis mode trying to figure out how to actually get this movie made.
Mm-hmm.
And the other movie seemed like I could sit around like sipping cappuccino, and we had so much time and so much money.
Right.
And I kind of like having my back against the wall a little bit.
Wow.
And then we cast the whole movie, and it turns out after all that work of putting Sarah in the movie, the people who were funding it backed out.
Yeah, I heard that.
I was in it?
What was the cumulative effect of the whole cast?
Okay. Yeah, I saw that. I could say that it was because there was no white male star. Like, he said that in a previous interview. Is that true?
I mean, all we know is we got a call from Mickey on a Sunday night saying, don't bother coming in tomorrow morning, we're shutting down. This was maybe like 6 weeks before we started shooting.
Wow.
Because the financiers pulled out, and my agent was like, see, this is why we told you should take the studio film.
Mm-hmm.
And, but instead of giving up, the next morning we went into the office, John August and myself, and the sort of most junior producer, Paul Rosenberg, and we're like, we're not going to let this thing die. And John August and I didn't really know anyone, but Paul Rosenberg knew a lot of people, and he would just literally pick up the phone and call anybody at any studio that he knew and pitch the movie. He'd start pitching, and then he'd hand the phone to either John or myself, and we would take over describing the movie, talking about it, talking about the cast, and meanwhile, Paul was on another phone because the production office was still open. There wasn't a movie to produce. And we had production assistants Xeroxing scripts and running them all over town. And by the next morning, we had a few studios interested in stepping in to take over. And by Wednesday morning, I was back in prep.
Wow.
I mean, and that's like, that never happens.
Right.
When I look back at that now, I'm like, how... It's the thing we were just talking about before. Like, sometimes, like, what you don't know... is better.
Yeah.
Like, I think now I've lived through too much that if I got that call, the movie shut down, I'm like, okay, there's no point in trying.
Right, right.
But I guess we just, it seems so naive to think you could just, like the scene I'm describing is a very accurate description of what happened. And you're like, it just sounds like you're doomed to fail. Like, how the hell did that work?
Right, right.
I feel like that's what also that you live for, moments like that where you can pull out the impossible.
Like, yeah.
That's kind of...
Yeah, I mean, the whole movie seemed like it was going to be impossible.
Yeah.
Did you know about this at the time?
Or I don't think I knew that part.
No, I mean, it happened so fast.
Right.
I knew the part where, like, I almost didn't come, remember? Because I got stopped at the border.
Yeah, yeah.
So then when I tried to come, which, like, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the States since then, so, like, I'm pretty comfortable there now, but I was raised to be absolutely terrified of the United States of America. Like, I had a father who, the only time he was, like, so, sort of violently, like, anti-American in this way that was almost religious, and the only time he had ever been to the United States, he found himself in a hotel room in Washington for a conference the same day as the Cuban Missile Crisis started. And he was like, I'm going to die here. And he came home and he's like, I'm never going again. So this was what I was raised by. So I go to the border to go, you know, be in LA for, for my first protracted period in the United States. And I get stopped at the border and they were like, really aggressive with me, and that got taken into a small room, and I was like, I'm gonna miss my flight, and then they started referring to me as a troublemaker, and these like customs officials were totally terrifying. So they, instead of waiting, I was like, I want to go home.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, no, we have to process. And I was like, don't worry about it, I don't need to go to the States, I'm going home. Like, I won't try again, and I'm good. And I got in a car and I went home, and I was like, I can't do the movie because I can't cross the border. I'm not going back into the room with the Americans. I was like really scared. Yeah. And which, you know, in retrospect, now I would be scared. Like, there was nothing to be scared of then. Now I would be scared. Yeah. But they were like, you know, try again. And then when you're in LA, you can go to the customs thing and we'll work it out. I'm like, 100% no. Like, we can get you a temporary permit to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what the problem was with my visa. But, like, they were not letting me into the country.
Did you have a visa at the time? Was it, like, a work visa?
It was some kind of work visa, but, like, they wanted me to sort it out later. And I was like, I'm not going into the country, period. And then you got, like, some senator involved to get my
Chuck
visa
Schumer.
There. Chuck Schumer got me into, for go.
Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And so then I was like, if you can promise me there'll be no issues when I go to the border, I will go, but I'm terrified. So, like, you actually got Chuck Schumer to come for go. And then I was like,
Is this because you have, like, your family is in politics, right?
Yeah, my father was, yeah.
Right, right, okay. So that was the pull, I guess? Like, or, like...
I mean, I knew Chuck is an extremely close family friend.
Okay, yeah.
And
that must have been really annoying to have to deal with that, given how busy his day
is. No, but he does. It's not him. It's somebody in his office.
Okay.
Mm.
But still.
And
they've got better things to do, I'm sure.
No, that is, in fact, what senators do. I mean, he is my senator. I do live in New York.
Mm.
It is something that senators and Congress people do, is, you know, respond to their constituents who have problems.
Like, you can't get...
Canadian across the border. You can't smuggle Canadian.
By the way, you know, probably 400 people had worked for 2 months or longer because of post, because you came into the country. So it's in fact.
I think you might have been able to make the movie without me, but you know.
Why were you bent on Sarah? I mean, because you hadn't met Sarah before.
No, like, I seen a sweet hereafter, and I was like, I want her.
Okay. And so we were just dead. Because, I mean, I read something about, like, she was the only one that just got a straight-up offer while everyone else had to come in for readings or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, did you know that?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So. But, again, I think that was the advantage, especially, like, when I was younger, of truly not caring. Like, I can't tell you what an advantage that has been in my career, is that
there are sure we started with Sarah coming in audition, and they're like, no, she passes.
Yeah. And then we just... No, it's like, it makes you so much more attractive to people when you are absolutely out of reach. That I have gotten jobs that I had no business getting.
Right.
Only because, like, I was a little more difficult to reach than other people. Like, that's the only reason. And I think that with you, like, if you listen to Doug and what, like, makes him tick, it's all about
getting what's really hard or the impossible. So I'm convinced if I had come in and read for Go, I wouldn't have got the part. It's because I wouldn't meet with you.
Yeah, yeah.
Doug's just nodding in agreement. He's like, yeah, you wouldn't have gotten the part.
Yeah, exactly.
But, okay, so you pulled that hard to get play and stuff, and this is now let's jump forward, because that play didn't work for Bourne Identity, as I understand. Or is that true? Like, I've just read this,
passed on.
You did pass. I was like, the part is Canadian. It's literally Canadian. Seriously, how many Canadian parts are there out there for American movies?
This is the lead role, the lead female role in Bourne Identity,
I mean, what are the odds that Robert Ludlum would have written a Canadian female lead in a spy movie?
To be fair to myself, and this is not one of those moments where I was doing before, where I was like, I've grown and now I'm not as militant. I am this militant still. It was during the war in Kosovo, and the draft I read, which I think changed, although I never saw the movie because I was really offended. The draft I read, all the Serbians were the villains. And I was like, are you crazy? Like, we're going to make a movie, like, demonizing Serbian people during, like, bombing Kosovo? So I was like, no. But then of course, I forgot it's a Doug Liman movie. So, like, I don't even know if you remember there were Serbians in it.
I don't remember the Serbians,
So, like, you know, like, it's like...
That's not in the final movie.
That's not even anything to do with what's in the movie, the script.
Well, once we didn't have a Canadian co-lead, we had to go German, yeah, everything changed.
I see.
But, I mean, you might have been, because I actually... If you remember, I said, Matt's in New York, and we're reading some actresses against Matt. And would you come down to New York, it's so easy from Toronto, and read opposite him. And you were like, I am not coming down to New York to audition for you. There was no version of me. I said, it's just a chemistry read against Matt.
Fair enough.
And you were like, I am not.
I mean, I guess we should get back to Go. Have you watched Go since
again? I have watched Go. I watched it at the Moscow International Film Festival because I was there because Guinevere was there too. And I went to this screening, and my favorite poet of all time, Yevgeny Yevtushenko, showed up to the screening.
Uh-huh.
So I was supposed to introduce the film, but then I thought he would be kind of like, he's very political, so I thought he'd be kind of critical of the film. So I kind of like, in my intro, tore the film apart so that like he wouldn't be critical of me.
Yeah.
Like it was such a horrible like Judas move.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, I feel the filmmaker was trying to make a film about America, but didn't understand, you know, the subtext of what he was saying, which is in America, how desperate, you know, it was a terrible portrayal of you, of like the movie. And it was like, in retrospect, I really liked the movie. But so that was the only time I saw it. But I saw it like shaking that I was about to be judged.
Did you not come to Sundance?
Oh yeah, I went to Sundance. Yeah, yeah. I came to Sundance. That was amazing. Because it was like a Who concert or something. Like,
yeah, yeah.
It was like bananas how... And then it's really weird now, that movie, because my nieces now wear like all the clothes from Go. Like rave culture's back.
Yeah.
They're wearing the like black and white like sneakers that I was wearing, and I'm going like, you know why you're wearing those sneakers? It's because I wore them in a movie. And they're like, yeah, Auntie Sarah.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, really, I was young once and cool. But it's so weird how like the clothes from Go exactly are back right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, it's a very strange thing being old enough to see that. Like, I remember when we were, you know, 17, 18, like hearing people in their 40s talking about like the hippie era, and hippie stuff was starting to come back, and they were also smug and gross about it and constantly reminding you that, oh, I should clear up my clothes and see if I have any clothes you'd like. And it's like, I feel like now I'm doing that. I'm old enough that I'm like, I had those sneakers the first time around.
But that's part, I mean, because the thing is, I mean, Go is a movie about 20-year-olds or almost 20-year-olds, and now it's 20 years old. And you're seeing this whole other generation that probably never seen it or don't know about it, because it was really like, that was a movie of that moment, but it's like, I feel like it has so much appeal today. Because I mean, in terms of what's dated about that, I mean, just think about the music, like that song. Was it Smash Mouth or the...
The No Doubt or the...
The one that's also in the trailer.
We should have watched
it. Let Me Steal Your Sunshine.
Oh yeah.
Do you know...
Len?
Len, that's it. Yeah, so like, I mean, I don't know that how many people, kids today, would remember that song.
Yeah,
remember
how
it was all over the place at that time. And I think, and also the song you use in that scene I was talking about.
But it's a great soundtrack even today.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, but it's just like, it's funny how like, I don't know that the 20-year-olds today would know that, which is why I think I'm excited to have them revisit it and discover it. But In terms of the other casting, actually, there's two things I wanted to circle back to because I think we totally skipped it. You were totally trying to make an independent movie, and then it became a studio movie, right? So, like, I mean,
but it was like it was called the negative pickup because it's right. it's still small and it's at arm's length from the studio,
mm-hmm.
and so they don't, because to make an independent movie, you're doing, you know, it's. You're not sort of following necessarily all the procedures a studio does when it's a studio movie. So they kind of need enough sort of plausible deniability.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it's basically they have an agreement to buy the movie when it's done.
Okay.
And off of that, you can get a loan to go make the movie.
Okay.
So I did have studio executives at Sony, but like, they were very much at arm's length. It's very different than, say, Bourne Identity, where Universal's like paying for the movie.
Right, okay.
Outright. But nonetheless, we were like, you know, we're so not a studio movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the whole time I was making the movie, I was kind of like, this is the last movie I get to be a rebel in.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to have to grow up.
Right.
So I kind of had this feeling the whole time we were making the movie that this was going to be sort of an end of a period for me, and that after Go, everything would be different because I couldn't, at a certain point, you know, because I already turned 30, I was like, you gotta grow up, and like, you can't just rebel against the system your whole life.
Right.
But I was like, I got one more in me, and that's Go.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of good to have like Columbia Pictures hanging over us because there was something to rebel against.
Right. Well, I mean, I think you commented on this as well, that, like, it's funny. Like, you guys did something with the logo that wasn't very common back then, where you cut the logo with rave music or like, just interrupted it.
Well, that's because originally it was TriStar. Sony has two labels, TriStar and Columbia Pictures. And we were TriStar, which is a younger, hipper label.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point while we were editing, they sent over the Columbia Pictures logo, which is, you know, been on some of the great movies of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor, I surround myself by people who are, you know, fairly critical of me. and my editor was like, oh my God, we're going to ruin 100 years of Columbia Pictures history with Go. We have no business having this, you know, it's this black and white logo. I mean, it was like such a regal logo.
Yeah.
And so we immediately started fucking with it. And being like, we just have to sort of, we can't run the logo as it normally is, because we're the opposite of Columbia Pictures.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I remember that was like the first instance. I was hooked from that logo moment, right? Like, and then all of a sudden the rave comes in, which is again back to that moment.
And were you a big raver, Brad?
I wasn't a big raver. No. I mean, think about it. I'm brown. Like, I'm not gonna be a big raver, right? Like,
so what was it?
It was just that it was so big that it was starting to like come into your circle. So I started dabbling with it, and dabbling with everything in it.
Okay.
But at the same time, I mean, like, I wasn't someone that was dedicated to it or whatnot, right? As soon as all my friends were able to get into bars and clubs, then that's where we shifted to. But at that time, you think about it, a rave is, it's all ages, there's no alcohol, you can go, you can get high.
Right.
It's an all-night thing. It's an atmosphere for kids at that age that are breaking into their independence.
Right.
That's why it was such a huge thing at that moment, right? And all the attention that was
coming. I was such a dork at the raves I went to.
Oh, well,
I don't do drugs and so I was like, but I'm like trying to sort of experience a little bit of life, and they were like selling these surgical masks with some kind of like some kind of medication sort of rubbed on the mask, and everyone was wearing them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I've never seen that. No.
It's like it's turns out it's Vicks Vapor Rub.
Okay.
Which I guess if you've taken a drug and then you wear this mask with Vicks Vapor Rub, it enhances the experience.
Mm, yeah.
But I'm just wearing the mask that I'm taking the drugs. I just have like very clear sinuses.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's my memory of raves are very hazy, as you would understand.
And so why did the film have such an impact on you? Like,
Just because it was like, well, first of all, I mean, this is a movie that, I mean, it's been compared to Pulp Fiction so many times. Like, this is Pulp Fiction for teens, right? And so this is like a movie that grabbed what I love from that, but also made it about people that are partying. I mean, I wasn't a big raver, but I saw that scene, and then it was just that youth vibe also, right? Like, it's you working in a grocery store and telling this woman, you know, what is it? Look at where you ended up and stuff, right? And it's just that energy of it, right? Going out, smoking weed, getting in trouble, and not really learning anything from it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's and The Rave being in the vicinity of that, it was the only movie of that kind that just kind of captured that vibe of what people were at that moment. And I think that moment was short-lived, which is why I feel like this is a movie that really had an impact on a brief period, like a people who were in that moment at that time would, like, this would be like the movie that captured it, you know?
Uh-huh. It might have been more people being impacted by it had Sarah done some press.
I am sorry. I actually do feel regret about it, like, genuinely.
Like, I don't regret it.
You know, but now having, you know, made my own films and, like, how desperately you need the actors to support the film, and it really is, like...
Like, it means way more to me that 20 years later someone's seen it wants to talk about it
right.
than anything that would have happened at the time.
Oh, I've made it up for you, though. You stay in my basement all the time.
Yeah.
You know. Doug always lives in my basement, so that's my way of making it up to you.
Well, you, I mean, things worked out pretty well.
His career was such a failure after that, and I blame myself.
I mean, Go was such a... Go was one of the things where, like, it really didn't attract a big audience when it came out, which I kind of knew going into it. I said, this is going to be a very hard movie to promote.
Right.
I didn't know that Sarah wasn't going to do any press, but I just knew, even if she had, it's still been a very hard film to promote, because it doesn't reduce to, like, a single sentence.
Right.
And I just wanted to make the movie anyhow. Because it really was a defining moment in my life where I was like, I'm not going to be able to rebel against the system afterwards, because it's not going to be becoming, because you can't, certainly you have to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And this, after this movie, I'm going to have to grow up. And then went on to go make a film, big movie, Born Identity for Universal. And I pretty much took on the system there and taking on the life. I'm not sure if...
See, saying things like that while it's ongoing is probably not going to help.
Do I need to edit that out?
Sure. But, I don't, but is it... But, it, you know, I haven't figured out whether Go had... Whether I've changed the way I thought I was going to change after Go.
That's interesting.
You know, the movie means so much more to me than you because, you know, I lived with it for so much longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, but except that when I emailed her, she recollects it being a great experience, right? The first question I asked Sarah is this one of your terrible experiences? Should we even go back to this topic? And she's like, no, I love Go.
No, it was great. It was a great experience. It was a great experience because it was like, yeah. I mean, there aren't that many directors that you work with as a young actress who are like respectful and treat you as a colleague and a peer and like, but also, I did, like, that's probably why I ended up making films, right? Like, I honestly had never thought of directing a film in my life, and then listening to Doug talk about directing films and the way he was doing it made me want to apprentice him for no real reason. I didn't have an idea for a movie, but it was such an adventure, and he included us so much in it, and is so, like, an open book about the ways in which he's... I'm not looking at you right now because I'm saying nice things, but it's very uncomfortable for both of us. But, like, you know... He's so open about what he doesn't know and the ways in which he's kind of like, you know, his thinking is a mess, but he's sort of working through it anyway that you feel like you could do it too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sort of opening the process, whereas I feel like a lot of filmmakers want to show an expertise that doesn't exist by withholding and being cagey. And so I felt like, suddenly it felt like, this looks really interesting. And this looks like, you know, something you can do, even if you don't feel like you have the skills, you know, you can open the manual to the camera and just do it. Like, it just felt like,
he literally had the manual.
He literally had the manual open on the cashier station looking. And then we would just sort of try things and yeah. And then I'd stop being scared of the United States by being there. But yeah, it was, I mean, when I look back on the experience I had making films after that, like that was one of the more kind of fun, exciting experiences I think I had, despite myself. You know, like, I was very earnest and very humorless.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, even I had to admit, this was a really fun experience.
Yeah. Did you just open her up forever in terms of, because she's one of the funniest people I know, talented-wise, so it's like, is this...
Yeah, but she was funny while we were working together.
Okay.
So but, I mean, I had, like, a lack of humor about, I don't know.
But you would... I mean, not when she's talking about Kosovo, you know.
Oh, okay, all right. So, Well, did you do something where you pranked her with a fake puppy or something?
God.
Or oh, because was that
there were many pranks.
What was your favorite, Sarah?
How do you know about that?
That wasn't an EW. That was the only press was EW visited the set of Go, and apparently that's all they caught. Like, because it's an EW set visit, but all they got was a quote from you, and you pranked Sarah with a puppy.
Yeah, so he kept saying, "There's this. Your wrap gift is a surprise." So I was wrapped before they went to Las Vegas for that shoot.
Okay.
I was like pretty happy to go home. Like I had fun, but I was ready to go home. And he was like, "You know, there's a present, a big wrap gift for you, and I think you're gonna really love it." So I got really excited about what the wrap gift was. Like, I was so excited. And the truth was that the present was, like, getting to keep going with the crew to Las Vegas, which was, like, not what I had in mind for, like, because I was good. Oh, you said it's to apprentice. I was like, I've apprenticed you for a month. I'm good. Like, I'm learn what I'm going to learn.
Yeah.
But so I think that he was then trying, he sort of had a sense I would be disappointed in it somehow. So he kept having all these ideas of what the gift may be. And he saw this really manky dog with, like, one leg around the studio. And he was like, pretend it's that dog,
mm-hmm.
like, as a joke.
Yeah.
And because I hate when people tell me what's going on, I wanted to know. But then they couldn't find that dog. So there was, like, one of the duty cops had the cutest puppy I've ever seen in my life. And it was presented to me as my puppy. Because
uh-huh.
the person carrying out the joke and AD didn't get that the joke was it was, like, a really ugly dog.
Yeah.
So I was given this puppy and I was so happy. I was crying and the puppy was licking me up. And the Doug was like, no. That's that's not your present. So that was, like, quite emotional.
Yeah.
I didn't go to Las Vegas in the end. No.
Yeah. No, it was a good rap, though. Okay, what are the other pranks, then?
Oh, I don't want to remember them, because
you know, okay.
I'm staying in her house. She remembers some of them.
You know what? The one that I remember is one that we would have found funny in the 90s and is no longer funny.
Your passport?
There was that. Oh, yeah, I would say, to protect Doug's reputation, we should not go into the pranks you played, which I found funny. But objectively, we're not cool pranks to play on a 19-year-old actress. But let's leave it at that.
I mean, I think we were dating by the time the passport prank happened, so that was...
Yeah, you were mad that I was leaving. So he, like, wrote, like, disgusting things on my passport.
No, which
once again, I had a border problem trying to
leave the
country.
I just made a fake stamp in your passport.
Yeah, it wasn't cool. Anyway...
Did the borders kind of...
They caught it.
They caught it.
It was a nightmare.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a total nightmare. These are not pranks you play now. They were pranks you play.
I mean, the world... I mean, first of all, the main reason you don't play it now is because it would highlight that these are things that, like, privileged white people can get away
with.
Yeah,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And therefore, for that very reason...
Yeah. It's actually unbelievable if you think about that. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I think about that a lot just in my life. I mean, even just Go, the whole idea of Go, the thing that I think, you know, there's always some part of me in every movie I make. And even if you're like, well, he doesn't do drugs and you go to raves, and like, where are you in Go?
Mm-hmm.
But there's always something in my own life that is the reason that I want to make that movie. It's not just I like that story and it's somebody else's story. There's something personal to me. And for me, it was that it was about sort of being like 18 and having a get out of jail free card.
Mm-hmm.
Because I felt like when I was 18, you could sort of get away with anything. And you really did have a get out of jail free card. And I wanted to do a movie that sort of celebrated that and be like, you know, while you're young, like, go for it.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, I am older and more political and I'm like, you know, that's a very privileged view of the world. Cause like, yeah, kind of a privileged white 18-year-old has a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not everyone has that. And therefore, you know, it's sort of... I still wanted to make a movie about what I connected to and about being young and free and getting away with stuff.
Yeah.
But I can't help but also just be aware that, you know, had I been born in other circumstances... The very events in my youth that sort of made me want to go make Go would have turned out very differently. Yeah. And I would have had a different attitude. I would not have been like, oh, when you're 18, you're free, you can get away with stuff. I've been like, so I'm not quite sure how to process it, but it's, you know, because there's the sort of there's who I am and what I experienced, in which I put all that heart into it go, and then there's sort of the political side of me that thinks, you know, the world's unfair.
There was a memory of, there was a scene where Katie and I have to be making each other laugh. Like, we're both cashiers near the end of the movie, we're trying to make each other laugh. And Doug wanted it to be a real laugh and to be something unexpected. So, like, on Katie's off camera, I did something like really disgusting. Like, I can't remember what it was, but it was disgusting. And then Doug was trying to figure out what could Katie do to surprise me that would make me laugh that hard. So Katie had a giant, beautiful, like, American apple pie when I turned around with, like, such a sweet grin, and then just, like, shoved the pie in her own face. It was, like, one of the funniest things I've ever seen. It was just, like, she was mocking her own sweetness so beautifully. It was, like, it was just amazing.
Because when you were shooting it, she wasn't, like, America's sweetheart yet, right? Like, Dawson's Creek
wasn't. She was on Dawson's Creek, but no, I actually, one of my fondest memories of that production was just hanging out with Katie and becoming friends with her, and she was just such a truly good, kind
person. I mean, she really is. Like, we were shooting in nice places, and I remember we were shooting near, like, a highway overpass, and we're, like, ready to roll, and we're like, where's Katie? And she's gone to sort of check on a homeless person who's, like, living, like, under the highway. Yeah, she really is, like, she genuinely has a great heart.
Right. It's interesting, that kind of stuff doesn't get talked about as much, like, in terms of Katie. Like, I don't hear that side of her as much.
Yeah, and that was never, like, I mean, I've known her all these years.
She wasn't doing that to show off, it's just something just wandered off to go do this.
Yeah.
But I've known her all these years, and, like, her kindness and sweetness has never been in absence. I mean, there's, like, media stuff at various points in her life, but, the person I knew when she was 19, that same person is there, has always been there, and she's just absolutely wonderful. And
the media is not really interested
deeply intelligent
in doing stories about how great or kind somebody is. It's just, who wants to read that?
She's pretty amazing. But I remember, I feel like my memory, I just remember it being really, really fun and feeling really free. And I think there is, like, this spirit of youth in the film, and I feel like I got caught up in that, and I feel like at that age, I wasn't necessarily that acquainted with feeling young. You know, I felt old since I was really little, and I remember just feeling, it was great to be part of something that made me feel my age, and Doug just made it really fun and an adventure, and you never knew it was going to happen. And he's so good at being made fun of. He's such a good sport about it, so that was really helpful.
I think that's also part of it, though, because I did grow up watching you on Rotel and Lee, and then I did grow up, and then I did watch Sweet Hereafter as a teenager, and that was my first Canadian film I had actually ever seen.
Oh, really?
Sweet Hereafter, yeah. Like, it was just because it got the Oscar attention and stuff, so I'm like, what is this movie? And rented it and watched that. And it shook my world.
Which is also fun.
Oh, wait,
and young.
Yeah. No, but that's the thing, though. But then you go from Sweet Hereafter to Go, and first of all, you're growing up alongside me then, because I'm watching, you know, as I'm growing up. Yeah. But it's like, oh, all of a sudden, Sarah Pauly's not a pioneer, and she's not, like, you know, she's not a victim on a bus. She's out there, like, drug dealing. Like, it was just like, that's our Sarah Pauly.